The Way of Knowing. Later that afternoon, when it seemed increasingly unlikely that the Empire would launch an attack from Dras Leona in the few remaining hours of sunlight, Aragorn and Saphira went to the sparring field at the rear of the Varden camp. There Aragorn met with Arya, as he had done every day since arriving at the city. He asked after her, and she answered briefly. She had been stuck in a tiresome conference with Nasawada and King Orin since before dawn. Then Aragorn drew his sword, and Arya hers, and they took up positions opposite each other. For a change, they had agreed beforehand to use shields. It was closer to the reality of actual combat, and it introduced a welcome element of variety into their duels. They circled each other with short, smooth steps, moving like dancers over the uneven ground, feeling their way with their feet and never looking down, never looking away from one another. This was Aragorn's favourite part of their fights. There was something profoundly intimate about staring into Arya's eyes, without blinking, without wavering, and having her stare back at him with the same degree of focus and intensity. It could be disconcerting, but he enjoyed the sense of connection it created between them. Arya initiated the first attack, and within the span of a second, Aragorn found himself standing hunched over at an awkward angle, her blade pressed against the left side of his neck, tugging painfully at his skin. Aragorn remained frozen until Arya saw fit to release the pressure and allow him to stand upright.
"That was sloppy," she said.
"How is it you keep besting me?" he growled, far from pleased.
"Because," she replied,
and fainted toward his right shoulder, causing him to raise his shield and leap backward in alarm.
"I've had over 100 years of practice. It would be odd if I weren't better than you now, wouldn't it? You should be proud that you've managed to mark me at all. Few can."
Brisinger whistled through the air as Aragorn struck at her lead thigh. A loud clang resounded as she stopped the blow with her shield. She countered with a clever twisting stab that caught him on his sword wrist and sent icy needles shooting up his arm and shoulder to the base of his skull. Wincing, he disengaged, seeking a temporary reprieve. One of the challenges of fighting elves was that because of their speed and strength, they could lunge forward and engage an enemy at distances far greater than any human could. Therefore, to be safe from Arya, he had to move nearly 100 feet away from her. Before he could put much distance between them, Arya sprang after him, taking 2 flying steps, her hair streaming behind her. Aragorn swung at her while she was still airborne, but she turned so that his sword passed along the length of her body without touching it. Then she slipped the edge of her shield underneath his and yanked it away, leaving his chest completely exposed. Fast as could be, she brought her sword up and again pressed it against his neck, this time underneath his chin. She held him in that position, her large, wide-set eyes only inches away from his. There was a ferocity and intentness to her expression that he was uncertain how to interpret, but it gave him pause. A shadow seemed to flit across Arya's face then, and she lowered her sword and stepped away. Aragorn rubbed his throat.
"If you know so much about swordsmanship," he said, "then why can't you teach me to be better?"
Her emerald eyes burned with even greater force.
"I'm trying," she said, "but the problem is not here."
She tapped her sword against his right arm.
"The problem is here."
She tapped his helm, metal clinking against metal.
"And I don't know how else to teach you what you need to learn, except by showing you your mistakes over and over again until you stop making them."
She wrapped his helm once more.
"Even if it means I have to beat you black and blue in order to do it."
That she continued to defeat him with such regularity hurt his pride far more than he was willing to admit, even to Saphira, and it made him doubt whether he would ever be able to triumph over Galbatorix, Murtagh, or any other truly formidable opponent, should he be so unfortunate as to face them in single combat, without the help of Saphira or his magic. Wheeling away from Arya, Aragorn stomped over to a spot some 10 yards distant.
"Well," he said through clenched teeth, "get on with it then."
And he settled into a low crouch as he readied himself for another onslaught. Arya narrowed her eyes to slits, which gave her angled face an evil look.
"Very well."
They rushed at each other, both shouting war cries, and the field echoed with the sounds of their furious clash. Match after match they fought, until they were tired, sweaty, and coated with dust, and Aragorn was striped with many painful welts. And still they continued to dash themselves against one another with a grim-faced determination that had hitherto been absent from their duels. Neither of them asked to end their brutal, bruising contest, and neither of them offered to. Saphira watched from the side of the field, where she lay sprawled across the springy mat of grass. For the most part she kept her thoughts to herself, so as to avoid distracting Aragorn. But every now and then she made a short observation about his technique, or arias, observations that Aragorn invariably found helpful. Also, he suspected that she had intervened on more than one occasion to save him from a particularly dangerous blow, for at times his arms and legs seemed to move slightly faster than they should have, or even slightly before he intended to move them himself. And when that happened, he felt a tickle in the back of his mind that he knew meant Saphira was meddling with some part of his consciousness. At last, he asked her to stop.
"I have to be able to do this myself, Saphira," he said. "You can't help me every time I need it."
"I can try."
"I know. I feel the same way about you. But this is my mountain to climb, not yours."
The edge of her lip twitched.
"Why climb when you can fly? You'll never get anywhere on those short little legs of yours."
"That's not true, and you know it. Besides, if I were flying, it would be on borrowed wings, and I would gain nothing by it, other than the cheap thrill of an unearned victory."
"Victory is victory, and dead is dead, however it is achieved."
"Saphira," he said warningly.
"Little one."
Still to his relief, she left him to his own devices after that, though she continued to watch him with unceasing vigilance. Along with Saphira, the elves assigned to guard her and Aragorn had gathered along the edge of the field. Their presence made Aragorn uncomfortable. He disliked having anyone other than Saphira or Arya witness his failures, but he knew the elves would never agree to withdraw to the tents. In any event, they did serve one useful purpose, aside from protecting him and Saphira, keeping the other warriors on the field from wandering over to gawk at a rider and an elf going at it hammer and tongs. Not that Blodgarm's spellcasters did anything specific to discourage onlookers, but their very aspect was intimidating enough to ward off casual spectators. The longer he fought with Arya, the more frustrated Aragorn became. He won two of their matches, barely, frantically, with desperate ploys that succeeded more by luck than skill, and that he never would have attempted in a real duel unless he no longer cared for his own safety. But except for those isolated victories, Arya continued to beat him with depressing ease. Eventually, Aragorn's anger and frustration boiled over, and all sense of proportion deserted him. Inspired by the methods that had granted him his few successes, Aragorn lifted his right arm and prepared to throw Brisinger at Arya, even as he might a battle axe. Just at that moment, another mind touched Aragorn's. A mind that Aragorn instantly knew belonged neither to Arya nor Saphira, nor any of the other elves, for it was unmistakably male, and it was unmistakably dragon. Aragorn recoiled from the contact, racing to order his thoughts so as to ward off what he feared was an attack by Thorn. But before he could, an immense voice echoed through the shadowy byways of his consciousness, like the sound of a mountain shifting under its own weight.
"Enough," said Cleda.
Aragorn stiffened and stumbled forward a half-step, rising onto the balls of his feet as he stopped himself from throwing Brisinger. He saw or sensed Arya, Saphira, and Blodgarm's spellcasters react as well, stirring with surprise, and he knew that they too had heard Gleda. The dragon's mind felt much the same as before, old and unfathomable, and torn with grief. But for the first time since Oromis's death at Gilead, Gleda seemed possessed of an urge to do something other than sink ever deeper into the all-enveloping morass of his private torments.
"Gleda, Elder,"
Aragorn and Saphira said at the same time.
"How are you?"
"Are you all right?"
"Did you?"
Others spoke as well. Arya, Blodgarm, two more of the elves, whom Aragorn could not identify, and their mass of conflicting words clattered together in an incomprehensible discord.
"Enough,"
Glader repeated, sounding both weary and exasperated.
"Do you wish to attract unwanted attention?"
At once everyone fell silent, as they waited to hear what the Golden Dragon would say next. Excited, Aragorn exchanged glances with Arya. Glader did not speak immediately, but watched them for another few minutes, his presence weighing heavily against Aragorn's consciousness, even as Aragorn was sure it did with the others. Then in his sonorous, magisterial voice, Glader said,
"This has gone on long enough. Aragorn, you should not spend so much time sparring. It is distracting you from more important matters. The sword in Galbatorix's hand is not what you need to fear the most, nor the sword in his mouth, but rather the sword in his mind. His greatest talent lies in his ability to worm his way into the smallest parts of your being and force you to obey his will. Instead of these bouts with Arya, you should concentrate on improving your mastery over your thoughts. They are still woefully undisciplined. Why then do you still persist with this futile endeavor?"
A host of answers leaped to the forefront of Aragorn's mind. That he enjoyed crossing blades with Arya despite the aggravation it caused him. That he wanted to be the very best sword fighter he could, the very best in the world if possible. That the exercise helped calm his nerves and shape his body. And many more reasons besides. He tried to suppress the welter of thoughts, both to preserve some measure of privacy and to avoid inundating Glader with unwanted information, thus confirming the dragon's opinion about his lack of discipline. He did not entirely succeed, however, and a faint air of disappointment emanated from Glader. Aragorn chose his strongest arguments. "If I can hold Galbatorix off with my mind, even if I can't beat him, if I can just hold him off, then this may still be decided by the sword. In any case, the king isn't the only enemy we should be worried about. There's Murtagh, for one, and who knows what other kinds of men or creatures Galbatorix has in his service. I wasn't able to defeat Durza by myself, nor Varog, nor even Murtagh. Always I've had help. But I can't rely on Arya or Saphira or Bloodgarm to rescue me every time I get into trouble. I have to be better with a blade, and yet I can't seem to make any progress no matter how hard I try."
"Varog?"
Glader queried.
"I have not heard that name before."
It fell to Aragorn then to tell Glader about the capture of Feinster, and how he and Arya had killed the newly born Shade, even as Oromis and Glader had met their deaths, differing kinds of deaths, but both still mortal ends, while battling in the skies over Gilead. Aragorn also summarized the Varden's activities thereafter, for he realized that Glader had kept himself so isolated he had little knowledge of them. The account took Aragorn several minutes to deliver, during which time he and the elves stood frozen on the field, staring past each other with unseeing eyes, their attention turned inward as they concentrated on the rapid exchange of thoughts, images, and feelings. Another long silence followed, as Glader digested what he had learned. When he again deigned to speak, it was with a tinge of amusement.
"You are overly ambitious if your goal is to be able to kill shades with impunity. Even the oldest and wisest of the riders would have hesitated to attack a shade alone. You have already survived encounters with two of them, which is two more than most. Be grateful you have been so lucky, and leave it at that. Trying to outmatch a shade is like trying to fly higher than the sun."
"Yes," replied Aragorn, "but our foes are as strong as shades, or even stronger, and Galbatorix may create more of them just to slow our progress. He uses them carelessly, without heed for the destruction they could cause throughout the land."
"Eberthil," said Arya, "he is right. Our enemies are deadly in the extreme, as you well know."
This she added in a gentle tone.
and Aragorn is not at the level he needs to be. To prepare for what lies before us, he has to attain mastery. I have done my best to teach him, but mastery ultimately must come from within, not without." Her defense of him warmed Aragorn's heart. As before, Gleda was slow to respond.
"Nor has Aragorn mastered his thoughts, as he must also do. Neither of these abilities, mental or physical, is of much use alone, but of the two, the mental is more important. One can win a battle against both a spellcaster and a swordsman with the mind alone. Your mind and your body ought to be in balance, but if you must choose which of them to train, you should choose your mind. Arya, Blodgam, Yela, you know this is true. Why have none of you taken it upon yourselves to continue Aragorn's instruction in this area?"
Arya cast her eyes at the ground, somewhat like a chastised child, while the fur on Blodgam's shoulders rippled and stood on end, and he pulled back his lips to reveal the tips of his sharp white fangs. It was Blodgam who finally dared reply. Speaking wholly in the ancient language, the first to do so, he said,
"Arya is here as the ambassador of our people. I and my band are here to protect the lives of Saphira Brightscales and Aragorn Shadeslayer. And it has been a difficult and time-consuming task. We have all tried to help Aragorn, but it is not our place to train a rider, nor would we assume to attempt it when one of his rightful masters was still alive and present, even if that master was neglecting his duty."
Dark clouds of anger gathered within Gleda, like massive thunderheads building on the horizon. Aragorn distanced himself from Gleda's consciousness, wary of the dragon's wrath. Gleda was no longer capable of physically harming anyone, but he was still incredibly dangerous, and should he lose control and lash out with his mind, none of them would be able to withstand his might. Blodgam's rudeness and insensitivity initially shocked Aragorn. He had never heard an elf speak to a dragon like that before. But after a moment's reflection, Aragorn realized that Blodgam must have done it to draw Gleda out and prevent him from retreating into his shell of misery. Aragorn admired the elf's courage, but he wondered whether insulting Gleda was really the best approach. It certainly wasn't the safest plan. The billowing thunderheads swelled in size, illuminated by brief lightning-like flashes, as Gleda's mind jumped from one thought to another.
"You have overstepped your bounds, elf," he growled, also in the ancient language. "My actions are not for you to question. You cannot even begin to comprehend what I have lost. If it were not for Aragorn and Saphira, and my duty to them, I would have gone mad long ago. So do not accuse me of negligence, Blodgam, son of Ildred, unless you wish to test yourself against the last of the High Old Ones."
Baring his teeth even more, Blodgam hissed. In spite of that, Aragorn detected a hint of satisfaction in the elf's visage. To Aragorn's dismay, Blodgam pressed on, saying,
"Then do not blame us for failing to fulfill what are your responsibilities, not ours, old one. Our whole race mourns your loss, but you cannot expect us to make allowances for your self-pity when we are at war with the most deadly enemy in our history. The same enemy who exterminated nearly every one of your kind, and who also killed your rider."
Gleda's fury was volcanic. Black and terrible, it battered against Aragorn with such force, he felt as if the fabric of his being might split asunder like a sail caught in the wind. On the other side of the field, he saw men drop their weapons and clutch at their heads, grimacing with pain.
"My self-pity," said Gleda,
forcing out each word, and each word sounding like a pronouncement of doom. In the recesses of the dragon's mind, Aragorn sensed something unpleasant taking shape, that if allowed to reach fruition, might be the cause of much sorrow and regret. Then Saphira spoke, and her mental voice cut through Glader's churning emotions like a knife through water.
"Master," she said, "I have been worried about you. It is good to know that you are well and strong again. None of us are your equal, and we have need of your help. Without you, we cannot hope to defeat the Empire."
Glader rumbled ominously, but he did not ignore, interrupt, or insult her. Indeed, her praise seemed to please him, even if only a little. After all, as Aragorn reflected, if there was one thing dragons were susceptible to, it was flattery, as Saphira was well aware. Without pausing to allow Glader to respond, Saphira said,
"Since you no longer have use of your wings, let me offer my own as a replacement. The air is calm, the sky is clear, and it would be a joy to fly high above the ground, higher than even the eagles dare soar. After so long trapped within your heart of hearts, you must yearn to leave all this behind and feel the currents of air rising beneath you once more."
The black storm within Glader abated somewhat, although it remained vast and threatening, teetering on the edge of renewed violence.
"That would be pleasant. Then we shall fly together soon. But, Master..."
"Yes, youngling."
"There is something I wish to ask of you first."
"Then ask it."
"Will you help Aragorn with his swordsmanship?"
"Can you help him?"
"He isn't as skilled as he needs to be, and I don't want to lose my rider."
Saphira remained dignified throughout, but there was a note of pleading in her voice that caused Aragorn's throat to tighten. The thunderheads collapsed inward on themselves, leaving behind a bare grey landscape that seemed inexpressibly sad to Aragorn. Glader paused. Strange, half-seen shapes moved slowly along the edge of the landscape, hulking monoliths that Aragorn had no desire to meet up close.
"Very well," Glader said at long last. "I will do what I can for your rider, but after we are done on this field, he must let me teach him as I see fit."
"Agreed," said Saphira.
Aragorn saw Arya and the other elves relax, as if they had been holding their breath. Aragorn withdrew from the others for a moment, as Triana and several other magicians who served in the Varden contacted him, each demanding to know what they had just felt tearing at their minds, and what had so upset the men and animals in the camp. Triana overrode the others, saying, "Are we under attack, Shadeslayer? Is it Thorn? Is it Shrukan?" Her panic was so strong, it made Aragorn want to throw down his sword and shield and run for safety. "No, everything is fine," he said as evenly as he could. Glader's existence was still a secret to most of the Varden, including Triana and the magicians who answered to her. Aragorn wanted to keep it that way, lest word of the Golden Dragon should reach the Empire's spies. Lying while in communication with another person's mind was difficult in the extreme, since it was nearly impossible to avoid thinking about whatever it was you wanted to keep hidden. So Aragorn kept the conversation as short as he could. "The elves and I were practicing magic. I'll explain it later. But there's no need to be worried." He could tell that his reassurances did not entirely convince them, but they dared not press him for a more detailed explanation, and bade him farewell before walling off their minds from his inner eye. Arya must have noticed a change in his bearing, for she walked over to him, and in a low murmur asked, "Is everything all right?" "Fine," Aragorn replied in a similar undertone. He nodded toward the men who were picking up their weapons. "I had to answer a few questions."
"Ah, you didn't tell them who..." "Of course not."
"Take up your positions as before,"
Glader rumbled, and Aragorn and Arya separated and paced off 20 feet in either direction. Knowing that it might be a mistake, but unable to restrain himself, Aragorn said,
"Master, can you really teach me what I need to know before we reach Urabain? So little time is left to us, I..."
"I can teach you right now, if you will listen to me.
said Glader.
But you will have to listen harder than ever before.
I am listening, Master. Still, Aragorn could not help wondering how much the dragon really knew about sword fighting. Glader would have learned a great deal from Oromis, even as Saphira had learned from Aragorn. But despite those shared experiences, Glader had never held a sword himself. How could he have? Glader instructing Aragorn on fencing would be like Aragorn instructing a dragon on how to navigate the thermals rising off the side of a mountain. Aragorn could do it, but he would not be able to explain it as well as Saphira, for his knowledge was second-hand, and no amount of abstract contemplation could overcome that disadvantage. Aragorn kept his doubts to himself, but something of them must have seeped past his barriers to Glader, because the dragon made an amused sound, or rather he imitated one within his mind, the habits of the body being hard to forget, and said,
"All great fighting is the same, Aragorn, even as all great warriors are the same. Past a certain point, it does not matter whether you wield a sword, a claw, a tooth, or a tail. It is true you must be capable with your weapon, but anyone with the time and the inclination can acquire technical proficiency. To achieve greatness, though, that requires artistry. That requires imagination and thoughtfulness. And it is those qualities that the best warriors share, even if on the surface they appear completely different."
Glader fell silent for a moment, then said,
"Now, what was it I told you before?"
Aragorn did not have to even stop to consider that I had to learn to see what I was looking at. "And I've tried, Master, I have."
"But still, you do not see. Look at Arya. Why has she been able to beat you again and again? Because she understands you, Aragorn. She knows who you are and how you think. And that is what allows her to defeat you so consistently. Why is it Murtagh was able to trounce you on the Burning Plains, even though he was nowhere near as fast or as strong as you?"
"Because I was tired, and—"
"And how is it he succeeded in wounding you in the hip when last you met? And yet you were only able to give him a scratch on the cheek. I will tell you, Aragorn. It was not because you were tired and he was not. No, it was because he understands you, Aragorn. But you do not understand him. Murtagh knows more than you. And thus he has power over you, as does Arya."
And still Glader spoke.
"Look at her, Aragorn. Look at her well. She sees you for who you are, but do you see her in return? Do you see her clearly enough to defeat her in battle?"
Aragorn locked eyes with Arya, and found within them a combination of determination and defensiveness, as if she was challenging him to attempt to pry open her secrets. But she was also afraid of what would happen if he did. Doubt welled up inside Aragorn. Did he really know her as well as he thought? Or had he deceived himself into mistaking the outer for the inner?
"You have allowed yourself to become angrier than you should," said Glader softly. "Anger has its place, but it will not help you here. The way of the warrior is the way of knowing. If that knowledge requires you to use anger, then you use anger. But you cannot wrest forth knowledge by losing your temper. Pain and frustration will be your only reward if you try. Instead, you must strive to be calm, even if 100 ravening enemies are snapping at your heels. Empty your mind and allow it to become like a tranquil pool that reflects everything around it and yet remains untouched by its surroundings. Understanding will come to you in that emptiness, when you are free of irrational fears about victory and defeat, life and death. You cannot predict every eventuality, and you cannot guarantee success every time you face an enemy. but by seeing all and discounting nothing, you may adapt without hesitation to any change. The warrior who can adapt the easiest to the unexpected is the warrior who will live the longest. So look at Arya, see what you are looking at, and then take the action you deem most appropriate. And once you are in motion, do not allow your thoughts to distract you. Think without thinking, so that you act as if out of instinct and not reason. Go now, and try.
Aragorn took a minute to collect himself and consider everything he knew about Arya. Her likes and dislikes, her habits and mannerisms, the important events of her life, what she feared and what she hoped for, and most importantly, her underlying temperament. That which dictated her approach to life and to fighting. All that he considered, and from it he attempted to divine the essence of her personality. It was a daunting task, especially since he made an effort to view her not as he usually did, as a beautiful woman he admired and longed for, but as the person she actually was, whole and complete, and separate from his own needs and wants. He drew what conclusions he could within such a brief span of time, although he worried that his observations were childish and overly simplistic. Then he set aside his uncertainty, stepped forward, and raised his sword and shield. He knew that Arya would be expecting him to try something different, so he opened their duel as he had twice before, shuffling in a diagonal toward her right shoulder, as if to circumvent her shield and attack her flank where it was unguarded. The ruse would not fool her, but it would keep her guessing as to what he was actually up to, and the longer he could maintain that uncertainty, the better. A small rough rock turned under the ball of his right foot. He shifted his weight to the side so as to keep his balance. The motion caused a nearly indiscernible hitch in his otherwise smooth stride, but Arya spotted the irregularity and leaped at him, a clarion yell ringing from her lips. Their swords glanced off one another once, twice, and then Aragorn turned, and possessed of a sudden and deep-seated conviction that Arya was going to strike next at his head, he stabbed at her chest fast as he could, aiming for a spot near her breastbone that she would have to leave open if she swung at his helm. His intuition was right, but his reckoning was off. He stabbed so quickly, Arya did not have an opportunity to move her arm out of the way, and the hilt of her sword deflected Brisinga's dark blue tip and sent it sailing harmlessly past her cheek. An instant later, the world tilted around Aragorn, and bursts of red and orange sparks appeared, scattered across his field of vision. He staggered and dropped to one knee, supporting himself with both hands on the ground. A dull roaring filled his ears. The sound gradually subsided, at which point Glaedhr said,
"Do not try to move quickly, Aragorn. Do not try to move slowly. Only move at the correct moment, and your blow will appear neither fast nor slow, but effortless. Timing is everything in battle. You must pay close attention to the patterns and rhythms of your opponent's bodies, where they are strong, where they are weak, where stiff and where flexible. Match those rhythms when it serves your purpose and confuse them when it does not, and you will be able to shape the flow of the battle as it pleases you. This you should understand thoroughly. Fix it in your mind and think on it more later. Now, try again."
Glaring at Arya, Aragorn got back to his feet, shook his head to clear it, and for what seemed like the hundredth time, assumed an on-guard position. His welts and bruises flared with renewed pain, making him feel like an arthritic old man. Arya tossed back her hair and smiled at him, baring her strong white teeth. The gesture had no effect on him. He was focused on the task at hand, and was not about to allow himself to fall for the same trick twice. Even before the smile began to fade from her lips, he was sprinting forward, Brisinga held low and to the side, while he led with his shield. As he hoped, the position of his sword tempted Arya into a rash, preemptive strike, a slashing blow that would have taken him in the collarbone if it had landed. Aragorn ducked underneath the blow, letting it bounce off his shield, and brought Brisinga up and around as if to cut her across the legs and hips. She blocked him with her shield, then shoved him away, knocking the air from his lungs. A brief lull followed, as they circled each other, both searching for an opening to exploit. The air between them was fraught with tension as he studied her, and she him, their movements quick and jerky, almost bird-like, from the overabundance of energy coursing through their veins. The strain broke, like a glass rod snapping in two. He struck at her, and she parried, their blades moving with such speed they were nearly invisible. As they exchanged blows, Aragorn kept his eyes riveted on hers, but he also strove, as Gleda had advised, to observe the rhythms and patterns of her body, while also remembering who she was and how she was likely to act and react. He wanted to win so badly, he felt as if he might burst if he didn't. And yet, despite all his efforts, Arya caught him by surprise with a reverse pommel strike to his ribs. Aragorn stopped and swore an oath.
"That was better," said Gleda. "Much better. Your timing was almost perfect."
"But not quite."
"No, not quite. You are still too angry, and your mind is still too cluttered. Keep hold of the things you need to remember, but don't let them distract you from what is happening. Find a place of calm within yourself, and let the concerns of the world wash over you without sweeping you away with them. You should feel as you did when Oromis had you listen to the thoughts of the creatures in the forest. Then you were aware of everything that was going on around you, yet you were not fixated on any one detail. Do not look at Arya's eyes alone. Your focus is too narrow, too detailed."
"But Brom told me..."
"There are many ways of using the eyes. Brom had his, but it was not the most flexible of styles, nor the most appropriate for large battles. He spent most of his life fighting one-on-one or in small groups, and his habits reflected that. Better to see widely than to see too closely, and allow some feature of a place or situation to catch you unawares. Do you understand?"
"Yes, master."
"Then once more. And this time allow yourself to relax and broaden your perception."
Aragorn again reviewed his knowledge of Arya. When he had decided on a plan, he closed his eyes, slowed his breathing, and sank deep within himself. His fears and anxieties gradually drained out of him, leaving behind a profound emptiness that dulled the pain of his injuries and gave him a sense of unusual clarity. Though he did not lose interest in winning, the prospect of defeat no longer troubled him. What would be, and he would not struggle unnecessarily against the decrees of fate. "Ready?" asked Arya, when he opened his eyes again. "Ready." They took up their starting positions, then stayed there, motionless, each of them waiting for the other to attack first. The sun was to Aragorn's right, which meant that if he could maneuver Arya in the opposite direction, the light would be in her eyes. He had tried before without success, but now he thought of a way he might be able to manage it. He knew that Arya was confident she could beat him. He was sure she did not disregard his abilities. But however conscious she was of his skill and his desire to improve, she had won the overwhelming majority of their matches. Those experiences had shown her that he would be easy to defeat, even if intellectually she might know better. Her confidence, therefore, was also her weakness. "She thinks she's better than me with a sword," he said to himself, "and maybe she is, but I can use her expectations against her. They'll be her undoing, if anything is." He sidled forward a few feet and smiled at Arya, even as she had smiled at him. Her face stayed impressively blank. A moment later, she charged him, as if she was going to tackle him and drive him to the ground. He sprang backward, edging to the right, so as to begin guiding her in the direction he wanted. Arya stopped short, several yards away from him, and remained as still as a wild animal caught in a clearing.
Then she traced a half-circle in front of her with her sword, while she stared at him. He suspected that having Glada watching them made her all the more determined to give a good showing of herself. She shocked him then by uttering a soft, cat-like growl. Like her smile before, the growl was a weapon for unsettling him, and it worked, but only partly, for he had come to expect such gestures, if not that particular one. Arya crossed the intervening distance with a single bound and began swinging at him with heavy, looping blows that he blocked with his shield. He let her attack without opposition, as if her blows were too strong for him to do anything more than defend himself. With every loud, painful jolt to his arm and shoulder, he retreated farther to the right, stumbling now and then to increase the impression of being driven back. And still he remained calm and composed. Empty. He knew that the opportune moment was going to arrive, even before it did. And once it had, he acted without thought or hesitation, without attempting to be fast or slow, seeking only to fulfill the potential of that single, perfect instant. As Arya's sword descended toward him in a flashing arc, he pivoted to the right, sidestepping the blade, while also putting the sun squarely at his back. The tip of her sword buried itself in the ground with a solid thunk. Arya turned her head so as to keep him in sight, and made the mistake of looking directly into the sun. She squinted, and her pupils contracted to small, dark spots. While she was blinded, Aragorn stabbed Brisinger underneath her left arm, poking her in the ribs. He could have struck her on the nape of her neck, and he would have if they had really been fighting. But he refrained, for even with a dulled sword, such a blow could kill. Arya let out a sharp cry as Brisinger made contact, and she fell back several steps. She stood with her arm pressed against her side, and her brow furrowed with pain, and stared at him with an odd expression.
"Excellent!" Glada crowed. "And again!"
Aragorn felt a momentary glow of satisfaction. Then he released his hold on the emotion, and returned to his previous state of detached watchfulness. When Arya's face cleared and she lowered her arm, she and Aragorn carefully edged around each other until neither had the sun in their eyes, at which point they began anew. Aragorn quickly noticed that Arya was treating him with greater caution than before. Most times that would have pleased him and inspired him to attack more aggressively, but he resisted the urge, for it now seemed obvious to him that she was doing it on purpose. If he swallowed her bait, he would soon find himself at her mercy, as he had so often before. The duel lasted for only a few seconds, though it was still long enough for them to exchange a flurry of blows. Shields cracked, chunks of torn sod flew over the ground, and sword rang against sword as they flowed from one stance to another, their bodies twisting through the air like twin columns of smoke. In the end, the result was the same as before. Aragorn slipped past Arya's guard with an adroit bit of footwork and a flick of his wrist, which resulted in him slashing Arya across her chest from shoulder to sternum. The blow staggered Arya, and she collapsed to one knee, where she remained scowling and breathing heavily through pinched nostrils. Her cheeks grew unusually pale, save for a crimson blotch that appeared high on each side.
"Again!"
ordered Glada. Aragorn and Arya complied without question. With his two victories, Aragorn's weariness had diminished, though he could tell that the opposite was true for Arya. The next match had no clear winner. Arya rallied and managed to foil all of Aragorn's tricks and traps, even as he did hers. On and on they fought, until at last they were both so tired neither was able to continue, and they stood leaning on swords that were too heavy to lift, panting, sweat dripping from their faces.
"Again,"
said Glada in a low voice. Aragorn grimaced as he yanked Brisinger out of the ground. The more exhausted he became, the harder it was to keep his mind uncluttered and to ignore the complaints of his aching body. Also, he found it increasingly difficult to maintain an even temper and avoid falling prey to the foul mood that usually beset him when he needed rest. Learning to deal with that challenge, he supposed, was part of what Glada was trying to teach him.
His shoulders were burning too much for him to hold his sword and shield in front of him. Instead, Aragorn let them hang by his waist, and hoped he could lift them fast enough when needed. Arya did the same. They shuffled toward each other, in a crude imitation of their earlier grace. Aragorn was utterly spent, and yet he refused to give up. In a way that he did not entirely understand, their sparring seemed to have become something more than just a test of arms. It had become a test of who he was, of his character, of his strength, and of his resilience. Nor was it Glaedah who was testing him, or so he felt, but rather Arya. It was as if she wanted something from him, as if she wanted him to prove what he knew not. But he was determined to acquit himself as well as he could. However long she was willing to keep sparring, so too was he, no matter how much it hurt. A drop of sweat rolled into his left eye. He blinked, and Arya lunged at him, shouting. Once more, they engaged in their deadly dance, and once more, they fought to a standstill. Fatigue made them clumsy, yet they moved together with a rough harmony that prevented either from gaining victory. Eventually, they ended up standing face to face, their swords locked at their hilts, pushing at each other with what little remained of their strength. Then, as they stood there, struggling back and forth without avail, Aragorn said in a low, fierce voice,
"I see you."
A bright spark appeared in Arya's eyes, then vanished just as quickly.